derivative of the metric, that of course comes from metricity. The second formula, that the Riemann curvature depends on the derivatives of the connection, so it involves two derivatives of the metric. I want to give you a little bit of a, this was all very algebraic. We derived the Riemann curvature by thinking of the commutator of two covariant derivatives acting on a vector. And we realized that the commutator did not involve any derivatives of the vector. And so it was equal to something times the vector, and the something is the Riemann curvature. So that's a completely sort of algebraic approach to the Riemann tensor. Now, it's also nice to think more geometrically what this Riemann curvature means. And one way to do that is to consider parallel transport along a curve. Okay, so imagine I have some curve, x mu of tau, in some particular coordinate system, and then I have a vector, s mu, which is going to depend on tau. So as I go along the curve, I want to carry this vector with me, and we already discussed the definition of parallel transport. Which is that ds mu d tau, which is defined to be ds mu d tau plus gamma mu nu lambda s nu dx lambda d tau equals zero. Okay, which is as close as you can get to saying that the vector s doesn't change as you go along the curve in a way which is not coordinate dependent. Okay, so that's the definition of parallel transport. Likewise, if I have a vector ds mu d tau, so if I parallel transport a covariant vector, that's a contravariant vector, covariant vector, then I have a minus sign here. Nu dx nu d tau s lambda lambda. Okay, equals zero. And of course, this equation implies that equation as long as I use the metricity condition. So if I lower components using the metric and use the fact that the metric is covariantly constant, then this the sign there changes. Okay, so how does the Riemann tensor come into it? So it turns out that the Riemann tensor measures what happens if I take a vector, if I parallel transport a vector around a closed loop. Okay, so I can imagine some vector s mu of tau. This point will be tau equals zero. And if I start with some vector at tau equals zero, and I just move it right around the loop and come back, and I ask, what's the change in the vector as it comes back? That change is given exactly by the Riemann tensor. So let's do that calculation. So let's consider a small closed loop. And when I say small, that's going to mean we can work to first order in the distance from any point. For convenience, I'm going to pick this point to be x equals 0 as well. Okay. You can always choose coordinates so that any given point is at x equals 0. So let me just do that to make life easy. So this is going to be x equals 0. The point tau equals 0 is going to be x equals 0. And then I'm just going to expand everything in sight in a Taylor series in powers of x, assuming x is small. X small. Okay. So I've assumed that that point is at x equals 0. So then the connection, of course, is whatever it is at x equals 0 plus x rho d rho gamma mu alpha. And this is all evaluated at x equals 0. Plus dot, dot, dot. Okay, so the higher order terms would involve two derivatives of gamma. And likewise, this vector, I'm going to take a downstairs vector. So S mu, yeah, let's put that index down. I'm going to transport around a vector with a downstairs index. This vector is whatever its value is at 0, plus, yes, so now I'm going to take this equation. I should have this is capital ds mu d tau equals little ds mu d tau. Yeah, sorry. Okay, i.e., ds mu d tau equals gamma s lambda dx nu d tau. Okay, so the parallel transport equation for s is a differential equation for s as a function of tau. And so I can integrate this equation to get S mu as a function of tau. But notice that if I work to lowest order in x, this equation just gives me that ds mu dx nu is equal to this gamma lambda mu nu s lambda. And I can use that in the Taylor series here. So I get gamma mu alpha gamma s gamma x alpha plus dot, dot, dot. OK, so these two equations give you s and gamma to leading order in the size of this little loop. Now I take the differential equation and get and just integrate it. S mu of tau is S mu of 0. So this is going to follow from here. S mu of tau is S mu of 0 plus integral 0 to tau d tau And then I'm going to substitute in my formula for gamma. So gamma mu alpha of 0 plus x rho of tau gamma d rho gamma mu alpha gamma. This is all at 0. Okay, and I'm going to work to second order in x in the displacement. And since we already have a dx d tau there, that allows me to go to only first order in each of these terms. So 0 gamma. This again, yeah, these would be at 0, 0. And then this is all multiplied by dx alpha d tau. Okay, so I just took this equation and integrated it with respect to tau using the fact that the integration constant is s mu of 0, because obviously when tau is 0, that's the value s takes. Okay, so now we look at this formula. At lowest order in x, we just have this multiplied by that, multiplied by this. So at lowest order, we get integral dx mu d tau times d tau. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if we have like a pre-index gamma, for example, with the first s, that gamma is not going to go away with
nothing. Yeah, sorry, maybe I haven't got my indices correctly lined up. Yeah, thanks. I think that should be a gamma. Just reading from that formula, right? That should be a gamma. And this should be a gamma. Yeah, sorry, I don't know what went wrong here. There's a mu and a mu. Is that better? There are too many mus. let's see. Yeah, dx nu. Thank you. That's here. Okay. And no, I think they're the right number of mus, right? This mu goes with that mu.
There's two mus in
seven. Oh, sorry. Sorry. Okay. Beta. Pardon? Sorry? This is a row. Yeah, that contracts with this guy. Sorry?
In the first gamma, the alpha would be the annual.
That's a new. And this is a new. Sorry about that. Okay, so hopefully that makes sense. I'm just literally reading this formula. Okay, so this term is that term, and this term is that term, except for some reason I relabel the lambda gamma, and then this term is this one. Okay. So at lowest order in x, if we treat x as small, I drop these two terms. I just have two constants multiplied by that integral. Okay, but if I go around a closed loop, this integral is 0. The integral of dx mu is 0. Right? If you just integrate something, a total derivative around a closed loop, then the answer. Then it comes back to the value, the original value. So I can just think of this as x mu evaluated x mu of tau between 0 and 0. And it's got to be identical. It's got to be 0. So the first non-zero, the only non-zero terms involve this times the dx d tau, and this times the dx d tau, and in both cases multiplied by the zeroth order term. So the lowest order non-vanishing contribution involves things which are quadratic in X, and I have S mu of 0, so this is around a closed loop, I have S mu of 0, and then plus, now these coefficients are all just constants, so let me pull them out of the integral. So I get d rho gamma, I'll just write this down and then check the indices make sense, plus gamma mu alpha gamma 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 delta rho s delta of 0, this is all at 0, integral x rho dx alpha d tor around a closed loop. Okay, so let's just check, probably, let me make this alpha a nu to agree with the above equation. That's a nu. And then I guess I've called this gamma gamma, and then this is presumably, let's call this one, here I have these two gammas with one wait, it's coming from this one times that one. So, I see. So let's call this, and then I'll have to let's call this beta. Sorry, that's not working out. I see. So I need that to be beta, this to be beta, so let's reveal that one gamma and this. Where is the gamma? Oh, that's presumably this guy. Let's see, did I get it finally? Except the rho is probably alpha. I think that works. Okay. Yeah, apologies, I should have checked these indices. Okay, so it should be clear where these two terms come from. This one multiplied by that times the dx d tau, and then this one multiplied by that one times the dx d tau. Now, if you look at this integral of x rho dx nu d tor, you can integrate by parts because this is a closed loop, and there's no surface term because it's closed. So this integral, we can integrate by parts. And so it's equal to minus integral around a closed loop of x nu dx rho d tor. OK, so this integral is antisymmetric on the row and nu. And so we can rewrite this as S mu of 0 plus 1 half. And then I take this term and I subtract off mu goes to nu. But because this is anti-symmetric, that'll just give exactly the same contribution. So of course, I'm doing that in order to make it look like the Riemann tensor. So d rho gamma mu nu gamma.
Whether you're taking the integral of something.
Yes. Plus gamma mu nu beta, gamma gamma beta rho. And then I simply subtract here. Rho goes to nu. OK, and all of that is multiplied by integral x rho dx nu d tau, d tau. Sorry? Oh, have I left out the s? Yes, sorry. Thank you. S gamma of 0. And so what we conclude from this is that that I get the vector at 0 plus 1 half, and then the Riemann tensor gamma mu rho nu s gamma of 0 integral x rho dx nu detor. Okay, so I had some. I have some vector here, s mu of 0. I carried it around the loop, and I find this change in the vector. This is the change in the vector. And it's given by the Riemann tensor. OK, now a simple example of this that you can easily imagine is if you take a piece of paper and cut out a wedge, and then you bring those two edges of the wedge together to form a cone. OK, so I'm going to get something like this. So if we just I bring those things together. And now you imagine parallel transporting a vector around this loop. OK, so if I had a vector, if I had a vector like this, for example, then in flat space, it's very obvious how it transports. Parallel transport, just the connection vanishes and everything. So so we just take it around the loop, and it would be, yeah, let me draw it carefully. So there, when it comes back, it's exactly the same. OK, but now when I identify those two edges, obviously I'm going to twist this vector relative to the other one. And by precisely this angle, theta. So if you cut out theta out of a piece of paper, then the change in the vector depends only on theta, depends on that angle, theta. And so what we say here is when you've done this, you've created, we have created curvature as a two-dimensional delta function so that if I look at this formula and I imagine that the Riemann curvature was a two-dimensional delta function, this is a two-dimensional surface area This is the area of the 2D surface. This is the area of a small 2D surface. And that's another way of looking at this effect, that the Riemann curvature causes a twisting in vectors as you go round. And it's sort of easier to see intuitively if you take the curvature to be isolated at a point. Now, so this theorem is that, or this result, that parallel transporting a vector around a closed loop gives you the Riemann tensor. And actually, this argument here, too, gives you a hint as to how you might prove that space-time is flat. In other words, there are coordinates in which the metric is eta mu nu, if and only if r is 0. Okay, and in fact, this is exactly how it is proven. And so in fact, you can prove that the Riemann tensor is 0 if and only if there exist coordinates in which g mu nu equals eta mu nu, right, using this result. And if you want to see the proof, Weinberg's book Gravitation and Cosmology. This is an old but very good book. And it's on page 138. Uses this result. Let's call that star. So this. So if the Riemann tensor is 0 everywhere, you can whenever you move vectors around, they're going to remain single-valued throughout space. Okay, so we want to do one more mathematical manipulation, and then we'll be ready to tackle the Einstein equations. So I want to derive, so remember we derived various formulae about the Riemann tensor. We had this formula, for example, sigma rho mu nu plus cycles of the last three indices. That followed from the Jacobi identity for the Jacobi identity for the covariant derivative acting on scalars. You might also ask, what about the Jacobi identity acting on vectors? Okay, so what is the Jacobi identity? It's this thing, d mu, d nu, d sigma, right, plus cycles. On some vector. And indeed, this gives you a new identity. Okay, so I'm going to derive that identity, not directly from this formula, which would be a little messy, but I'm going to derive it by using this trick of locally flat coordinates. So In order to derive it, it's useful to lower the index of the Riemann tensor. And so I'm going to give you a formula for the Riemann tensor to derive, this leads to the Bianchi identity. Okay, which is important in the construction of the Einstein's equations. So we can show that. And I will, I'm not going to go through the algebra. You can show that this Riemann tensor, R sigma rho mu nu with lowered indices, can be written in terms of second derivatives of the metric in this way. Okay, so this is the part we had before in the locally flat coordinates where gamma vanished. And I'm just adding the full term just to show you what it is. And it's actually important to know some properties of this term in order to derive the Bianchi identity. So this is an exact formula. This is exact. And if you want to see the derivation, it's in Weinberg's book, the same book, page 143. You can certainly derive it yourself just by expressing the gammas in terms of the g's and lowering an index, and you'll find lots of the terms cancel. And so this is the exact expression for Riemann with lowered indices. Okay, so in locally flat coordinates, right, gamma, first derivatives of the metric vanish, and gamma vanishes as well. But what we want to do is differentiate this guy. Now, the fact that this is quadratic in the gammas means that even when I differentiate this, even if the derivative of the gamma doesn't vanish, this term will still vanish, right? Because when I differentiate it, I get a derivative on gamma times a gamma. Even if the derivative of gamma is not zero, the gamma vanishes. So the fact it's quadratic in gamma is important. And so we can see that in these coordinates, R sigma rho mu nu semicolon lambda. Semicolon means I've got to include all of the connections. But of course, in these coordinates, all the connections are zero. Okay. So, but nevertheless, this is a true formula. This is equal to 1/2 d lambda times all this garbage. And that's it. Because even though I differentiated here, I have to differentiate these guys. But as I explained, even though the derivative is non-zero of gamma, it's always multiplied by gamma, which is zero. And from this formula, so now you have a formula in a particular coordinate system at a particular point relating this quantity to second derivatives of the metric at that point. And then what you can do is show that you just add cycles. And we know which cycles to add because the Riemann tensor's anti-symmetric on these two indices. So it's that comes from a commutator of d mu, d nu derivatives. And now I want to cycle these three indices around. And then I'll be getting the result of this Jacobi identity. So we write down this formula, sigma rho mu nu comma lambda, and now just cycle the last three indices. Sigma rho nu lambda mu plus r sigma rho lambda mu nu. Okay, so we would guess from this formula that that should equal zero. And if you write out all these terms, there will be 12 terms, and they will all cancel. Okay, and so this equals zero. And find that. So what we've shown is that this quantity, which is a tensor, if I evaluate it in this particular coordinate system, is zero, but that means it's zero in any coordinate system. Okay, and this is called a Bianchi identity. So actually, when Einstein worked out his theory, he didn't know about the Bianchi identity. Okay. This was discovered by Bianchi, I guess, sometime in the 19th century, based on Riemann's work. And for that reason, Einstein got his equation wrong. He wrote down an equation which was inconsistent. And then somebody pointed this out to him. It's not quite clear who or how. And he quickly corrected the equation. And got the right answer. Okay, so not surprising to get it wrong because this is really quite complicated stuff. Now, the way in which we'll use this equation is not in that form. We're going to contract some of its indices. So let's take that formula and multiply it by g sigma mu. Why? Because that's how I got the Ricci tensor. I contracted the first and the third index, right? Remember, it's anti-symmetric under these two and those two. So the only way to get a tensor is to contract one of the first pair with one of the second pair. So let's contract sigma with mu. And what we get from here is obviously the Ricci tensor. So then I get rho nu semicolon lambda. Notice that implicitly, I'm pulling this G inverse under the covariant derivative. That's OK, because G is covariantly constant. The derivative of G is, covariant derivative of G is 0. And by the way, I should have mentioned this, but the whole point of the covariant derivative is that it is a derivative. So the derivative of one function times another function is equal to, you know, the sum. So d mu of f g is equal to d mu f times g plus f d mu g. Okay, so you can easily check the covariant derivative satisfies this when f and g are any two tensors. So we multiply with the g, pull it under the derivative, doesn't matter because derivative of g is zero, and then contract the indices. That's what I get in the first term. In the second term, I'm contracting sigma with mu here. So what I get is r sigma rho nu lambda semicolon sigma. Okay. I just raised the sigma index. And then I have R sigma with mu. Now this time I'm contracting the first with the fourth index. Now I use the anti-symmetry on the fourth and the third index to pull the fourth one to the third. I get a minus sign. And then I contract and I get the Ricci tensor. So this will give me R rho lambda semicolon nu with the minus sign. Okay. So that's another identity that follows just by contracting the Bianchi identity. And now I still want to get rid of the Streamann tensor, so let's multiply this by G rho nu. And again, now I'm contracting the second with the third. It's almost the Ricci tensor, but I get a minus sign because I've got to, the Ricci tensor is the first with the third, or the second with the fourth. Okay, so I contract this guy, it'll give me a minus sign. So what I, and here I'm just going to get the Ricci scalar. So I get R semicolon lambda, then minus R sigma lambda sigma, and then over here I've got minus R rho lambda rho. These two are identical. So let's relabel rho as sigma equals 0. And so I can rewrite this as R sigma lambda, this term, minus 1 half R delta sigma lambda, semicolon sigma, equals 0. And so this quantity we define to be the Einstein tensor. Probably should be called a Bianchi tensor, but it's called the Einstein tensor. G sigma lambda. And so we have, if we now lower the index, we have G sigma lambda is the Ricci tensor, R sigma lambda minus 1 half G sigma lambda R. And it obeys D mu G mu nu equals 0. So obviously G with upstairs indices is just R with upstairs indices minus a half G mu nu R. And it has that special property that the covariant derivative contracted on one of its indices gives 0, and we call this divergence free. So we say that the Einstein tensor is divergence free. Okay, so now we are really ready to think about the field equations. Remember what Einstein's trying to do. He's trying to reproduce Newtonian gravity, okay, from all this geometrical machinery. So in the derivation of his field equations, he tried to write down something involving the curvature of space-time, which would reproduce all of Isaac Newton's results. So we want to reproduce Newton's theory of gravity in the limit of at small velocities and weak gravitational fields. Okay, so small velocities just means that the velocity, magnitude of velocity over c should be much less than one. Weak gravitational fields should mean that the metric is approximately flat space plus some perturbation, h, and the magnitude of h is much less than one, okay? Because the magnitude of eta is one. The matrix elements of eta are one, plus ones and minus ones, so you want the magnitude of h to be small. Approximately. This is approximately.
Okay.
Yeah, it's true. Okay, that's fine. Yes. When one does perturbation theory, it is conventional to write eta plus h squared plus h cubed, but actually in this case we don't need to. You're perfectly right. We will be expanding in powers of h. I think this will be fine. We will need the inverse metric. And to get the inverse metric, use the following identity. If you've got a matrix which is A plus B, right, and you want the inverse of A plus B, then the way to do this is to, of course, extract the A and write 1 plus B inverse A. In fact, I should probably have the A over there, shouldn't I? Minus 1. But let me write it out schematically. Not worry about the details. If I have a matrix of this form, 1 plus A, and A is small, and I write the inverse matrix, then I'm actually allowed to just use the ordinary rules of algebra, right? So this is like 1 over 1 plus x is what is 1 minus x plus x squared minus x cubed, dot, dot, dot. Right? So this is true for matrices as well. 1 minus A plus A squared minus a cubed, etc. So you could guess that if I've got this matrix eta plus h and I take the inverse, it's just going to be eta minus h. Okay, and that's easy to check that that is true. So g mu nu would be eta with raised indices minus h mu nu with raised indices plus order h squared. Okay, so to verify that statement, all I do is multiply this matrix by that. In the leading term, I just get eta down multiplied by eta up. That's going to give me a delta, Kronecker delta. Then I'm going to get this multiplied by that, which will give a minus h with one up, one down index. And this will give plus eta times h, also gives an h, one up, one down, and those two terms cancel. And then the remainder is of order h squared, and you can cancel it off by just going up in powers of h, just like in this example. So we'll need those identities. And now consider the motion of a particle, a massive particle. In the case where the metric, where H mu nu is independent of time. Okay, so d naught of H mu nu is zero. Why am I thinking about this? Well, the particle's moving slowly. What I want is a static metric. So think of the sun. The sun is deforming space-time, but the gravitational effect of the sun is independent of time. It's just sitting there at some deformed metric and no time derivative. Okay, and that's where Newton's theory should apply. So we just consider the geodesic equation, d tor squared plus gamma mu nu lambda dx nu d tor dx lambda d tor equals zero. So the geodesic equation in this slightly deformed Minkowski space. Now, when we look at this equation, the velocities are small. So dx0 d tau, dx mu d tau is, of course, this vector. Dxi d tau, right, has some time component and space components. But if the velocity is small, if v is much less than c, this condition implies that dxi d tau magnitude is much less than dx0 d tau. Right, remember x0 is c, ct. And the velocity is just dxi dt. And so the fact that the velocities are less than c implies that when you write the full velocity of the particle, the time component is much bigger than the space components. And so that means you can, let me just flip all these around. That means the geodesic equation simplifies a lot just because of small velocities. So the geodesic equation becomes d2xi d tor squared equals minus gamma I 0, 0 c squared dt d tor squared. That's the spatial components. And the time components just become d2t squared, sorry, d2t by dtor squared, because x naught is ct. And so d2, let me, I guess, write that explicitly. Minus gamma 0, 0, 0, c squared dt dtor squared. OK, and now we're going to use all the stuff about the inverse and the time derivative of h. So gamma 0, 0, 0 is equal to 1 half G00 or G, yeah, let's write it out, and then we will G0 alpha 0 plus G0 alpha 0 minus G00 alpha. Okay, so I'm just working out what gamma 00 is. Now, as I explained, time derivatives are 0, time derivative of eta is 0. By assumption, time derivative of h is 0, so these are 0. And now, this G inverse would be eta 0 alpha minus h 0 alpha plus order h squared. But this term here is already h 0 0 comma alpha. So you notice at linear order in h, the only term that matters is the eta times that h, right? This is already of order h. So I can forget about these guys, eta times h, but eta 0 alpha is 0 unless alpha is 0. So this is this 0 unless alpha equals 0, eta 0 alpha is 0 unless alpha equals 0. And so this, but then we get this is 0. But d0 h0 0 equals 0 by assumption. The metric is time, is static independent of time. And so we see that gamma 0 0 0 is of order h squared. And negligible. To first order. Okay, so all that argument allows you to treat that as zero. And now you've got a second order differential equation for t in terms of tau. And the solution is that t is linear in tau. So this equation tells you, so let's see, let's call that 1 and 2. So 2 tells you that t is proportional to tau. And so that means that if I look at in this equation, that this quantity here is just a constant, right? dt d tau is constant to linear order in h. And I can simply divide by that equation. So 1 becomes d2xi dt squared is equal to minus c squared gamma 00i. I'm going to leave the C into this derivation because we'll actually see explicitly how the C's arise and how they enter the final Einstein equation. So all we have to do is work out the gamma I 0, 0. Now gamma I 0, 0 is 1 half. In this term, I only need to keep the eta, which is because the derivative term is of order h anyway, I don't want to keep things of second order in h. And so gamma I 0, 0 is 1 half. So then I will have here G 0, j comma 0 plus g 0 j comma 0 minus g 0 0 comma j. The time derivatives are 0 by assumption. And so what I get here is that gamma I 0 0 is minus 1 half h 0 0 comma I. OK, so we have here that this is equal to 1 half h0, 0, comma I. And times c squared. You'll notice I haven't, I'm not being consistent about the I indices being up or down. This one is up, this one is down. That doesn't matter to leading order because eta ij is delta ij. Okay, and so if I raise and lower a quantity, it doesn't change to leading order. Okay, so we've derived that the particle moves according to h. So that's great. That's exactly what we wanted. We wanted that all particles, no matter what their mass, will fall, will see the same bending of space-time, and they will all follow the same trajectory. So this will mean immediately that this will explain Galileo's observation that the gravitational force is proportional to the inertia. So when you write F equals ma, the m is going to cancel because F is proportional to m. Okay, so that's good. That's exactly what we wanted of the gravitational force. But let's look at, I shouldn't use that one. Let me. Let's compare this with Newton. Newton told us that m d2x dt squared is equal to the gravitational force, which was the mass minus the mass times the gradient of the gravitational potential. Right? That was Newton's law of gravity. F equals ma, with F being given by the mass times the gravitational potential. And the gravitational potential is determined by Poisson's equations. That del squared phi is minus 4 pi g rho. And I'm going to call that rho m. This is the mass density. OK, so that's the entirety of Newton's theory of gravity. Certainly a lot simpler than anything we've done. OK, but it's wrong. And in Newton's theory of gravity, the fact that the gravitational force is proportional, that a particle feels is proportional to its mass, is just an assumption. Okay. So whereas in Einstein's theory, the cancellation of the mass follows from the fact that all particles are moving in the same geometry. And there really isn't a gravitational force. All there is a bending of space-time. Okay, so, but nevertheless, from Newton's formula, we can now read off what H naught is. Okay, in this weak field case, when we're in static metrics, we can identify this H naught C squared with grad phi. So it follows that for weak static fields, H naught naught should equal to minus 2 phi over c squared, where phi is the gravitational potential fixed by the Poisson equation. For example, for around a mass m, we have phi is equal to minus gm over r, right? So the gravitational potential due to the sun is minus gm over r, where m is the mass of the sun. And the force, of course, gives us, if I take the gradient of this potential, I'm going to get gm little m over r squared, which is Newton's inverse square law. And so it follows that let's call this a spherical mass m. The gravitational potential is minus gm over r, and so h naught naught is plus 2gm over rc squared. Okay, so now we have an explicit formula for the distortion of the metric caused by the gravitational field of a, or caused by a mass. We haven't derived this distortion of h naught naught. We've just simply said that if Einstein's theory is to reproduce Newton, somehow Einstein's equation, which we haven't yet derived, must give this as the answer. Okay, so this is all working backwards from the known result from Newton. And so g naught naught is minus 1 plus h naught naught, because eta naught naught is minus 1. And so this is equal to minus 1 minus 2 gm over rc squared. And here I really should have approximately, okay, because we've assumed h is small. And I'm not worrying about second order corrections. I'm neglecting second order corrections. So let's ask for some examples just to see how big is this correction to flat space. So let's take the surface of the Earth. We know what the gravitational potential is, and if you put in the numbers here, we're going to get h naught naught is 10 to the minus 9. Okay, so the correction to Minkowski space in this room right now, due to the Earth, is going to be 10 to the minus 9. At the surface of the sun, it's 10 to the minus 6. At the surface of a white dwarf, which is what our sun is going to collapse to when it runs out of nuclear fuel. It's 10 to the minus 4. Neutron star is even more dense objects, that slightly heavier stars collapse to form a neutron star. And the h naught naught is about 10 to the minus 1. And then, of course, at the surface of a black hole, the metric distortion is approximately 1. So as I said, that is simply that's not deriving the value of h. It's simply saying what h must be according to the field equations which determine h. But now we're ready to try to write down those equations. Okay, before I do that, are there any questions? So, so we need an equation. We need equations to determine H, or to determine G mu and H mu. And we know from the above what the answer is that we want. So the analog is with the Poisson equation. You see, the Poisson equation, Newton's equation told you how the particle moves, the F equals A, and that equation is analogous to the geodesic equation. But we need an analog of the Poisson equation, i.e. a covariant analog of the Poisson equation. Okay, covariant means that it should be a tensor equation. And so it should be valid in all coordinate systems. So Poisson looks like this. D squared phi is 4 pi g rho m. No speed of light anywhere in Newton's theory, of course. And so I've already inferred from the motion of the particle that phi is related to h naught naught by that formula. So phi is minus a half c squared h naught naught. So it follows that minus d squared h naught naught, which is 2 d squared, so in the weak field limit, I want an equation which looks like this. Phi over c squared, which is, of course, 8 pi g rho mass over c squared. So this is the equation I'm aiming at. I want an equation in which h naught will be determined by the mass density, right, in this manner. Now, the mass density is fixed by the energy momentum tensor. Okay, so T naught naught is the energy density. But by E equals mc squared, T naught naught over c squared is the mass density. Rho m. Okay, so I can write this as 8 pi g t naught naught over c squared. And actually, I'm going to put the indices down. There are two of them, so that won't change the sign. In special relativity, the metric is eta mu nu, and use that to raise and lower indices. So this is the
c to the 4th.
Thank you. Yeah, that's c to the 4th. Yeah, that's exactly why I kept track of the c's to explain that factor. So we're going to guess some field equation which, in the limit of weak fields and slowly moving particles, is going to reduce to that equation. So it's easy what to guess should be on the right-hand side of the equations. 8 pi g over c to the fourth times t mu nu. Right? I'll keep it with downstairs indices. So generalizing this equation, I should get to a right-hand side that's a good tensor. T mu nu is a good tensor, even in general relativity. On the left-hand side, I want something which involves second derivatives of the metric. Okay? So the obvious candidate is the Riemann tensor. But I need something where the indices will balance, will be the same as the stress-energy tensor. So what would be your first guess if you're Einstein? I want to write down something which for small metric perturbations and reduces to this. What's your first guess? Ricci tensor. That's exactly what he wrote down. So Einstein's first guess was that, right? Einstein's first guess. Okay, wrong. Okay. The reason it's wrong is that the stress tensor, stress energy tensor, its most basic property, its fundamental property, which is why it is a useful concept, is that it is conserved. Okay, so this is the conservation of energy momentum. Yeah, sorry, sometimes I call it the stress energy tensor, sometimes I call it the energy momentum tensor. The reason is that its components, T naught naught is the energy density, T naught I is the momentum density, Tij is the stress momentum, and the stress density. And I guess it's just too long to say energy momentum stress tensor, but they really are all there. Okay, and these equations of motion tell you, govern the motion of matter. In special relativity, these equations follow from Noether's theorem, right? In special relativity, remember translation symmetry in space and in time, those give you four symmetries because there are three translations in space and one in time, so you have four conserved quantities, and these are the equations. So you could attribute these to Noether. Okay, so it's very clear that if I'm going to write down a sensible quantity, it's better be consistent with this equation, and it better be consistent with the conservation of stress energy. And so we need x mu nu to satisfy, first of all, we need it to satisfy d mu x mu nu equals 0 in order for this to be a consistent equation. Now, we already have we have such a quantity. Here it is, the Einstein tensor. So that is therefore has a chance of being a consistent equation. So by this, from above, x mu nu is proportional. Can be any constant. Times g mu nu, which is just the Ricci tensor, minus 1/2 r g mu nu. So to work out the constant, all we need is to calculate the Einstein tensor for small metric perturbations. Right, so I'm going to calculate the Einstein tensor for g, for the metric equal to eta plus h, work to lowest order in h. And I want to check, does it reduce to this quantity? And if so, with what numerical factor? So we need to know what is r naught naught minus 1/2 g naught naught r. Now, to do this, it's a little bit subtle because we want to know something about hij. Even though hij doesn't enter that equation, we want to know something about hij in order that we include it properly in the full equation. So what we're going to do is assume gij, the spatial components, which are ij minus 1/2 gij r, is proportional to Tij. And we're going to assume that's much less than T naught naught. OK, so we're going to assume the spatial stresses, which are normally described quantities like the pressure in a system, those are down by V squared over C squared compared to these are down by V squared over C squared in typical systems in special relativity. So in ordinary, like in a gas, if you ask what's the pressure is the mass density times, is 1/3 the mass density times the velocity squared, the pressure in a gas, and much less than the energy density, which would just be mc squared, right? The pressure is mass density times V squared, the mass density of the gas in this room is the energy density is the mass density times C squared. So make that assumption. And so it follows that Rij is approximately equal to 1/2 delta Ijr. So now if we work out the Ricci scalar, this is approximately equal to minus r 0, 0 plus r kk. You see, because I'm only ever working to first order in h, the metric perturbation, r, the Ricci scalar, is going to be of order h. And so when I, the Ricci tensor is going to be of order h. And so when I contract it with g mu nu, to form the Ricci scalar, right? This is of order h anyway, so when I calculate the inverse metric, I can use eta and not worry about the h corrections. So this is a valid equation. And then I can take the trace of this equation to get, you see, if I sum these indices, I get 3/2 over there. So I get minus r 0, 0 plus 3/2 r. And now this is very nice because I can solve this equation to fix r in terms of r 0, 0. So we get r is approximately 2 r 0, 0. So this is this allows us to simplify G00, which involves both the Ricci scalar and R00 into simply R00. So G00 by definition is R00 plus 1/2 R. You see, where is G mu? G mu is this guy. So G00 is R00, and then eta 00 is minus 1. So I get plus 1/2 times R. But I've just solved for R, right? R is 2R00, so this is 2R00. Okay, so with these assumptions, we've reduced the left-hand side of the proposed Einstein equation to just calculating one quantity, which is R00. Okay, so sorry, this is a little bit intricate, but indeed this is what Einstein had to do. But we have from before R sigma rho mu nu is equal to 1/2 H nu sigma comma rho mu minus H rho nu comma sigma mu minus H mu sigma comma rho nu plus H rho mu comma sigma nu plus order H squared. So we had that before. To get R00, right, obviously what we have to do is to take two of these indices to be 0, and the other two to contract. We have to contract those with the metric, but the metric we can replace with eta, okay, because we're only working to lowest order in H. And so if these two indices are 0, we get this expression, minus R0000. But of course, this is 0 because R is antisymmetric. And if we work out, plus the spatial part, so this will be RI0I0. So all we have to do is work out this quantity with two indices equal to I and two equal to 0. And in fact, you can see where it comes from. You see time derivatives are 0 by assumption. So these two indices are 0. So anywhere rho appears in a derivative should be 0. Anywhere nu appears in a derivative should be 0. So that's 0. This is 0 because rho and nu appear. This one, rho, nu appears. So the only non-zero term is that one. And that one is easy. It's minus 1/2. And then we've got to put rho and nu equal to 0. So that's H00. And then we've got to put sigma and mu equal to I. So we have comma II. And of course, that is minus 1/2 grad squared H00. Phew. Okay. So after all that, you discover that G00 is 2R00 is minus grad squared H00. Okay, and we want to reproduce this equation up here. And so that tells us exactly what to do. The Einstein equations is, so I'm off by in order to reproduce that equation, I need, it's g mu nu equals 8 pi g over c to the fourth t mu nu. Okay, that's what it is. So, as you can see, there was sort of a lot of detective work involved in finding that equation. But the amazing thing about this equation, it didn't involve introducing any new constants into physics, right? No new parameters. This is known. This is Newton's gravitational constant. C was known. So this is an absolutely predictive equation. And that's why the LIGO discoveries are so amazing, because this logical chain of argument introduced no extra parameters into physics. And it predicts black holes, gravitational waves, the expansion of the universe, all of that, okay, for free in terms of number of parameters, no new parameters. It's absolutely remarkable. Yeah?
So when they talk about modifying gravity, what areas of its derivation they try to modify?
Right. That's a good question. So people do some really awful things. Okay. So let's think about what awful things we might consider doing. One of them is to make the equations higher than second derivatives. We've assumed here that this quantity, yeah, so we assumed about this x. So we assume x mu nu depends only on g mu nu and up to two derivatives. Okay, that's the crux of the assumption, that we're assuming this metric should really describe gravity, and we don't need any other fields or scalar fields or anything. Furthermore, we want field equations involving only two derivatives. Now, we can have a long, you see, his field equation involve only two derivatives. So what people typically do to generalize this is they allow x to involve more derivatives of the metric. Then this leads you into all kinds of puzzles and problems, because generally, field equations involving higher derivatives have more solutions. Right? If I have a second-order differential equation, it'll have two solutions. Third order will have three. So when you introduce more derivatives, there are more solutions. It's sort of worse than that. Some of these solutions are pathological. I mean, there are horrible instabilities which appear, which do not appear in Einstein's theory. It just happens. It took people many, many years to understand the properties of these differential equations. They're nonlinear, not like Maxwell. So these are sort of orders of magnitude more difficult than Maxwell's equations, because this is a nonlinear function of g. But nevertheless, people were able to prove that these equations make sense, they're stable, they don't lead to disasters. If you add high derivatives, that's not true. So generally, there are all kinds of disasters in high derivative versions of gravity. A simple thing you could do, which people do to an infinite extent, is they say, no, x mu nu might depend on some other scalar fields. All right, so let's introduce some scalar fields, and we can put these scalar fields into the field equations in whatever way we like. There's no evidence for them. There is evidence for the Higgs field. So it would make sense at some level that the Higgs field should come in. And in fact, it is still unknown precisely how the Higgs field comes into this equation. It's not known how the Higgs field couples to gravity. There's at least one extra parameter that comes in there, which people still debate over, and it's not measurable currently. But it's a dangerous game. Introducing scalar fields is a dangerous game because they're scalars, they don't transform much under coordinate transformations, or they don't transform. And it makes the whole theory much more arbitrary. You know, the imposition of this symmetry is most powerful when the objects you introduce transform in a major way, because basically those transformations make many different configurations equivalent. So because the metric does transform, the equations you can write down are very limited. For scalar fields, because they don't transform, you can write down almost arbitrary equations. So those are just some of the ways people try to vary these equations. None of them very appealing. I mean, these really are very, very minimal set of equations, and those are amazingly minimal assumptions. So that's what's so special about Einstein's theory, is that it's the minimal theory par excellence. No new parameters in physics, second derivatives only, minimal number of geometrical quantities, and that's it. Four dimensions. You know, the other way people vary this is by going to string theory. You know, that's a truly adventurous generalization of this, to say that space-time is not four-dimensional. It's 10-dimensional, 26-dimensional. And then you have a metric with a huge number of components, and then lots of other fields which come along. And all of them need initial conditions. All of them have field equations. There are infinite number of solutions. There's a multiverse. It's a kind of catastrophe, right? So when you go beyond Einstein, you quickly are led into sort of theoretical, landscape. And people talk about the landscape of theories. This is exactly what it is. It's a landscape where almost anything goes. So it's very interesting to use the LIGO measurements and other measurements to try to exclude these things. I mean, to try to exclude scalars. But it becomes, it's very arbitrary. And how you generalize Einstein is, to a large extent, a matter of taste. So any other questions? What we're going to do next time is begin to study solutions of this equation, and in particular, gravitational waves. But I guess you need a little break.